Mark Edelson from Iron Hill joins me this week to discuss the early years of craft brewing. This is Beersmith Podcast number 203.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 203, and it's early November 2019. Mark Edelson joins me from Iron Hill Brewing to talk about the early days of craft brewing. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They're currently offering 20% off their all-access subscription pass, with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith and get your all-access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also the BrewEasy. Brew big in small spaces with the best all-grain, ultra-compact system available. The BrewEasy's revolutionary setup combines batch sparge efficiency, brew-in-a-bag simplicity, and the wort clarification of a rim system. It's easy to set up, easy to operate, and easy on the eyes. Plus, it's fast and conveniently sized to help you save space and gain speed without compromising quality. Add the optional Brew Commander for precise temperature control and mash automation. With the BrewEasy, you'll discover the definitive proof that size isn't everything. Electric and propane models are available. It's also the system that I brew on. Visit BlickmanEngineering.com for more information. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. As I mentioned last week, I recently converted the Beersmith Recipes website to support mobile devices and added the majority of the Beersmith brewing tools now and unit conversion tools to the site. Subscribing to Beersmith 3, you can access over 17 brewing tools from any device. And anyone with an account can browse from tens of thousands of recipes. Visit beersmithrecipes.com for more information from your phone or computer to learn more. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome Mark Edelson, brewer and owner at Iron Hill Brewery in Philadelphia. Mark started as a home brewer and opened Iron Hill in 1996. He's brought home over 20 consecutive GABF awards and has been brewing since early 1990, I think, right? Mark, it's great to have you on the show.
Great. Thanks for having me, Brad.
So how are you doing today? How are things up there in Philly?
Terrific.
Terrific.
It's a little cold today. You know, this is an early cold. We missed fall. Unfortunately, I think fall is done and we're into winter.
It does get cold up there, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Yeah. So, I mean, you started out as a home brewer, and it looks like you started brewing, according to your bio at least, you started brewing around 1990 with a friend. What were those early home brewing years were like? Because I know I was brewing at that time as well.
Well, you know, it was a great time to be a home brewer. And today is even better because there's just so much more information out there, so much better equipment available to home brewers. But I brewed with my current partner, Kevin Finn. You know, he had actually gotten a homebrew kit from his girlfriend at the time, now his wife, and she lived up in Boston. So she wanted to keep him occupied. So instead of going out with me all the time, right? So she bought him a homebrew kit. So we started homebrewing together. You know, mostly we would do it on Sundays while watching football. And, you know, we really loved it as a hobby. It was a lot different back then. You know, we had a local homebrew shop here in Delaware nearby, which is no longer there. And so we would buy ingredients and try different things. And, you know, this was before you got on the internet to look things up. So
there wasn't really much of an internet in 1990, right?
No, not at all. So you bought books, you had Charlie's book and you sourced ingredients at the local homebrew shop and that was the extent of what you did. And you tried different things and the homebrew shop owner was the local expert. It was, you know, local homebrew clubs had just started popping up. So it was a much different time. And the equipment was the plastic buckets. You know, that was the extent of what we had and the Cajun cooker.
I had a plastic bucket and I think a 5-gallon porcelain pot was pretty much it. So,
right. Exactly. Yeah. And then we, you know, we went all out and bought glass carboys, right? That was our big spend.
That's that's pretty pricey there.
Yes. Yeah. So now I see, you know, cooled fermenters and, you know, and I look at homebrew recipes and see specific fermentation temperatures. And I thought, well, it used to be you just threw it in the coolest place of the house, right? Mm-hmm. And you got what you got.
Exactly. Yeah. I got a nice Blickman system now and I got a stainless fermenter. That's it's pretty high tech compared to the 90s. Yeah.
Yes.
So you two of you started together and then, somehow you decided to go, pro in the mid 90s, which was, very, very early in the craft beer revolution, really here in the U.S., right?
You know, we had been brewing for a long time and been successful in a lot of competitions. We really liked it. We both started hating the jobs we were in and thinking about how can we, turn this into, you know, a business. You started looking.
What was your previous job? What were you?
I worked in pharmaceutical manufacturing. So I was the manufacturing manager at a local pharmaceutical plant. So I have a background. I have a degree in chemical engineering. And so, you know, brewing and stainless steel and stainless piping and all that, I was very familiar with, you know, working under FDA guidelines and sanitation and all of that was second nature to the stuff that I was doing as a career.
It's interesting. A lot of the early brewers were engineers, like John yes. Palmer and myself, a lot of people that got involved early in the home brewing business were engineers.
Yes. So, you know, we found a good home in home brewing and then, you know, and then it started to make sense to look to make the jump. And, you know, back then, again, there was a lot less resources about how to start a brewery. What we loved about the industry, though, as we started to explore it, you know, we started to go to the Craft Brewers Conference. It wasn't, of course, called Craft Brewing at the time, right? So it was the old Institute for Brewing Studies, which eventually became the BA, right? And so we went to the conference, and I think our first one was in New Orleans in 92 or 93. Mm-hmm. And what was most engaging about it is everybody wanted to help you, right? And so you go there just to learn about it, and everybody that was in the industry at the time came to the conference, and everybody was willing to tell you information and help you get started. And so
I kind of still feel like homebrew cons that way. I don't feel like the craft. I went to the craft beer conference a couple of years ago. It was so monstrous. I couldn't find my way through it. But
it is. You know, when we were first going, it was in a hotel, right? The conference was in a hotel and the trade show was in, it always was in a hotel with a large conference center and the trade show was in a conference center, right? And now we can't go to certain cities because they don't have convention centers large enough to hold the Craft Brewers Conference.
So, yeah, I was in the one in Washington. I think it took me more than a day and a half or 2 days just to get through the show floor, literally.
So, the industry has changed, but I think what's very similar about the industry is, it's still people very willing to share information, you know, as styles develop and different products develop, getting information from brewers about how they do things is still just as easy, you know, if you form relationships with people, just as easy as it used to be. And that's what we continue to love about this industry.
So your motivation for getting into it originally was, though?
We were passionate about brewing, and we hated our jobs, right? So we really wanted to, right? We wanted to do something that was our own. Like, I worked for a big, huge international corporation, right? And so, you know, although I was doing well, my ability to influence what we were doing from a long-term perspective was non-existent, right? And so you just felt like you were working. And so, you know, we had that entrepreneurial spirit. And the craft brewing industry seemed exactly like the place where we could try to make a go of it. And so we did. We quit our jobs and we got our third partner. So we were constantly going back and forth saying, Should we open a packaging brewery? Should we open a brew pub? And we ended up thinking, you know, the brew pub maybe was the better way to go. I went to a beer tasting of my local college alumni association, and it was interesting because Jeff Ware, who was the founder of Dock Street, was there, and they were a contract brewing, and they were on the marketplace, so you were familiar with the brand. And he was at the beer tasting, and he rolled out these blueprints for what he was going to build in Philadelphia called a brew pub. And I looked at these things, and I'm like, look at this. It's a restaurant with a brewery right there on site in full view of the customers. And, you know, my partner and I, we talked about it, said, this is what we're going to do.
So I assume that's the model you eventually followed. And you've opened a number of other locations. Are you still using that model?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, at the time we were not restaurateurs, and, you know, food is an important part of the restaurant business. So we got our third partner, Kevin Davies, who was a local restaurateur involved, and he became a partner. So the three of us worked for about two more years after that and opened the first Iron Hill in 1996.
Wow. And what were some of the challenges when you opened that very first brewery? I think you were brewing out of glass carboys, right? And maybe a slight change.
Well, challenges from everywhere, right? We ran out of money about 2 weeks before opening. So that, you know,
that's pretty common though, isn't it?
Yeah. And so we had family and friends who, a lot of our investors are family and friends. We had them show up, and we finished painting and doing a lot of the work ourselves and assembling everything. But yeah, those are the, you know, from a brewing standpoint, you know, we got some help, from some friends of ours within the industry to help guide us in the initial startup of everything. But one thing I always say is the jump is not from home brewing to professional brewing is not as hard as you might think it is. And it comes down to one simple thing. The equipment is way better in professional brewing, right? Yeah. And it really is. Now, you know, the effects of making a mistake are far greater. Right. It's one thing to dump a 5-gallon batch, and it's another thing to dump a 300-gallon batch down the drain because of issues. But you know, when you have better equipment, it works out pretty good. So that was the first thing that I noticed, was like, wow, I can control my temperatures. I can, you know, do all these things that I struggle to do as a home brewer come a lot easier as a professional brewer.
So you decided to open up a restaurant as well. So you had, in addition to the brewing of the beer, you had to deal with all the issues associated with the restaurant. How did what were some of the challenges on that side of things?
Well, you know, the good part of doing that is that you always see your customers, right? You know, when you're in a packaging brewery, you know, you send the beer out, and if you're at events, you see customers, and, you know, but in the restaurant business, you know, customers are there. They look through the window and can see that. So that brought a lot of challenges. I didn't have a lot of experience in the restaurant business, only, you know, as a teenager, you know, waiting tables and things like that. But we had a restaurant partner, and he was well-versed and got us started with that. But back then, you did everything, right? So I would brew, and I would manage on the floor. I would help with the shifts. I would close some nights. So it really was a lot of, and when you're open your own business, I mean, you do what it takes, right? The dishwasher calls out, somebody's got to wash dishes, right? So it was a lot of hours and a lot of work, you know, and it is those first months were a big blur, right? But, you know, it's also exciting and fun. You have all this young, new staff. You know, it's something new. There was not a brewery in Newark, Delaware. And there's very few breweries in the state and in the region. And so it was exciting for customers. So it was a great time back then.
And how was it received once you got it all opened up? You mentioned you were in Delaware, right, at the time?
Yeah. Oh, you know, we exceeded our sales expectation out of the gates, which was great. It really was. I have to say that we sold more food as a proportion than we thought we were going to, which is exactly where we wanted to land. You know, I think, you know, we sell about 20% of our income comes from beer, 10 from wine and spirits and 70% from food. That's pretty much been the same since the beginning. I think we thought we'd do half of our income as beer. And so, which is in retrospect, that's more of a bar than it is a restaurant, and looking at it. And that's not what we were trying to be, you know, back in the day. I mean, the food in brew pubs in the 90s was mediocre at best and always had a bad reputation. And we said, you know, we are a restaurant, you know, and we always say that, you know, we are a restaurant, and we differentiate ourselves as an award-winning restaurant by having an award-winning brewery as well on site. And so I think that's what was missing in the marketplace in general, is brew pubs with excellent food. You know, I think people would go, oh, great, we're going to a brew pub, we're going to have some beer, but maybe we'll go to dinner afterwards or something like that, right? And that's not what we wanted customers to experience. We wanted them to have, from an experience side, everything, great service, great products in our beer, and great products in our food.
Nice. Obviously you're in the middle of running a business now too, right? So you went from working for somebody else, now you're running your own business, you're employing people, you're dealing with personnel issues, dealing with accountants. What are some of the business aspects that kicked in and maybe surprised you at the beginning?
One is to get a bookkeeper as soon as possible. Right? And we probably did. Important. You know what? Well, our accountant said, go hire a bookkeeper, right? Because you're so busy running the business and writing checks and all that, and nobody was, you know, balancing the deposits or doing any of that stuff. And I think every small business runs into it. And our accountant actually hired a bookkeeper for us and say, here, pay her and have her do your bookkeeping. And that was an important part of it. To see, were we actually making money?
Yeah.
Which we were, which was great, because we were out of money when we opened up. So that was good. But, you know, getting, not having come from the restaurant business, learning it and learning hospitality, and my partner having been involved with it, really helped drive that and made sure that, you know, because restaurants, you know, you get, you know, first impressions are...
They run on very thin margins too, from what I understand, right?
They do. I mean, yeah. You have to run it right, you know? My partner's always said it's a game of nickels and dimes. And it is. It really is. And you have to make sure you're watching everything. There's a lot of cash, right? And so you have to always watch that. And so... it was a challenge. It's a lot of work. But you have to, in the end of the day, you have to love hospitality. I always talk to people who say, well, I want to retire and open my own restaurant. I'm like, do you really want to do that? You know, is that what you really want to do? I mean, there's a reason.
Is that retirement?
No, not at all. Right. I always warn people, you know, there's a reason that, restaurants, if you look at the failure rate of restaurants, is very high, right? Everybody knows this. The banks know it. And the reason for that is, I think people get into the restaurant business having no idea what it really is, right? They see the fun side of it. You know, I'm going to open a restaurant and hang out at the bar with all my friends, right? And that's not the business at all. I mean, it's a lot of hard work. I always say it's the hardest way to make a buck is the restaurant business. Mm-hmm. So with that said, there's a lot of successful people in the restaurant business because they love hospitality. And we love hospitality, and I love hospitality from the beer end. You know, we certainly love when people drink our beers and get great comments, or, you know, or I was not a beer drinker and now you've given me these products and I love beer. I was talking with, somebody yesterday who, I had just met, and she, said, you know, I was not a beer drinker. I live near your media store. We would always go in. My husband would drink beer. And, you know, he goes, but I love coffee. So he gave me a beer, one of your stouts. And she goes, now I love stouts. And I drink stouts all the time. And I love craft beer. And, you know, and those are the things that, as a brewer, you know, you just really keep you going while you do this.
I'm a big fan of stouts. How'd you pick up your first lineup? How'd you decide which beers to brew first?
You know, things are, that's an interesting, it was well thought out. And, You know, back in the day, brew pubs had 6 beers, right? Now we have 15 plus beers all the time.
Yeah.
Because everybody wants lots of choice, right? But back then, you know, we had 5 or 6 beers to start off. So we really wanted to start, first of all, we wanted to have a lager all the time, right? And that was unusual for brew pubs. It's even unusual for brew pubs today. Because as you know, lagers take longer amount of time to make, more tank space.
About twice as long, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And so we said we definitely want to always have a lager, but we want to have a good palette of flavors. So at the time, we had a more of a golden ale. We had a Helles. We had an amber ale. Remember that style?
I do remember the amber ale. Very, very, very popular for a long time, actually.
It was, and it's no longer there, right? We had a porter, and our porter today, our pig iron porter, is still the same recipe. It's our only legacy beer that's left. And we had a wheat and an American wheat, and then we made a raspberry version of that. And we had a pale ale. We had a British pale ale, actually, right? That was our flagship beer as a British. So those were the beers we start. We thought it was a good palette of beers. We started doing 1 or 2 seasonals as well. That we could mix in, you know, it was one of these things where, we had such a big opening that we got very close to running out of beer. Well, that happened in the first 3 Iron Hills we opened up, right? We got very close to running out of beer.
Never want to run out of beer.
No, you don't. Right. And I can honestly say we never, ever have, but we came close and we would bring in other craft brewers. So when we were opened our Westchester location, we brought in some Victory, some Stouts, some Dock Street, some Independence at the time. And to help fill the taps, we still had some Iron Hill beer. But we don't have that problem anymore. We have enough breweries and enough capacity to make sure. And we start up a little better with a little more insight and capacity to be able to keep up with all that.
So how does the original lineup compare with some of your top selling beers today?
Like I said, nobody brews amber ales anymore.
Probably not.
IPAs were not something that you brewed as a seasonal here and there. And the IPA of the late 90s is not the IPA of today.
No.
But you know, Helles, still love brewing Helles. You know, we brew a light lager now as part of our lineup. The porter, right? So the porter, dark beer is still dark beer, right? You know, it's one of your lower selling beers. People get scared by color of beers, but the people that love it, right? And so
I am one of them.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the beer I always drink.
Yeah. Well, what are some of the favorite beers you've brewed over the years? What are some of the maybe unusual or interesting beers you've done?
All right, there's somebody in the room here is going to laugh at this one. But you know what? So I'll start with the beer that I guess I should never have brewed, and that was the Tabasco barrel aged beer.
Oh boy, that sounds good.
I thought it was great, but you know what? We bottled it, and maybe we should have pasteurized it because there's still some active stuff probably from the Tabasco barrels. So we had Tabasco bombs.
Oh no!
There was a beer writer who said online, if you're going to open this bottle, wear a hockey mask. It's like,
and what did it taste like?
It's great. You know what? We
goes well with pizza or what?
You know, we had to blend it off, so we didn't use it straight out of the barrel, and we blended it down. And, you know, I just like any chili beers, it's got a certain little sweetness you can taste in the chili, and then the heat comes on a little bit after that. But it was an interesting project, but I've been advised never to do it again. Right? But, you know, over the years, the things like our award-winning Russian Imperial Stout, that is such a great story behind that and how we formulated it and put it together.
Well, why don't you tell us about that one? Tell us the story.
We had a couple of our brewers were out at the Siebel Institute doing some of the training we sent them to, and they were out there for 2 weeks. And they were in a hotel room that had craft beers on. And for some reason, this hotel had Old Rasputin on, right? And so after going to class, each day, they would come back and drink Old Rasputin. And they sat there and they talked about it and said, we should brew, we should come up with a formula and brew a beer just like this, right? Mm-hmm. So that was their inspiration for it. And they came back and they put together this recipe. And I said, this recipe is way too complicated. You don't need to use this many ingredients. And they begged me to use the recipe that they had. And I was like, ugh, all right. And it tasted great. And from day one, it was one of our most award-winning beers that Iron. It is the most award-winning beer.
It's got some complexity to it, huh?
Yes, it does. It does. You know, and I was, there's a lot of times in my brewing career, I have to eat my words. One is I'm like, you guys are making this too complicated, right? You don't get credit for overcomplicated beers. And I was wrong on that one.
Well, you can get a certain depth by layering the flavors, you know?
Yes, you layer. I know.
If you,
I know.
More layers, more flavors, right?
But, you know, sometimes I look at some of our recipes, and I'm like, we don't need this many or this number of hops in this recipe, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of that going on.
You're overcomplicating it, and you don't get credit from it from the customer. Yeah. But, sometimes I'm wrong.
Well, other than the Tabasco beer, have you got other examples of unique techniques or ingredients you used over the years, maybe to make some kind of specialty
beer? We were doing lambics way before anybody was doing lambics. And we were doing lambics in a pub before anyone was doing lambics in a pub, right? And
that's cool.
And we were researching which Belgian beers were using other strains to prime in the bottles, but some had their original yeast and bacteria in the bottles, and we would research which ones had that. And then we would propagate out of the bottles and bring it up and we made lambics out of them, right?
In our brewer.
Yeah, and they were again GABF award winning beers for a long time before a lot of people were doing it, you know. And now so many more people sours.
Were you making cherry lambics or other kinds of lambic?
Yep, we did. You know what? We did a cassis.
Oh,
and
cassis.
We did strawberry, we did raspberry, we did cherry, but nobody was doing a cassis, right? And I always loved Lindemann's cassis, right? First, it was a challenge finding a farm where you could, well, buying black currants is a challenge, right? It certainly, you don't have them at the supermarket. And then finding growers. So we found some growers in Pennsylvania that were making black currants, right? And the guy dropped them off. He's like, you're putting these in beer? And he said, yeah. He goes, you know, these smell like cat piss, don't you? And we're like, exactly. That's exactly what we're going for. And he's like, what? I'm like, don't ask.
My favorite meat is black currant, so I would probably enjoy that. Yeah,
sure. And and it was a terrific product. It really was. And they're products that get better over 5 and 6 years, you know? And I remember the last bottles of these products that we had were unbelievable. They were so delicious.
Yeah, they do get better over time. Well, Mark, you've won a whole bunch of GABF awards over the years. What are some of the things that have made Iron Hills a success?
Well, you know, and I think part of it is the success in competitions, of course, is brewing to style, right?
Yeah.
There are categories for experimental and whatnot, but the majority of those are traditional styles or newly developed American styles, but it's judged to style. And I think, you know, being an engineer, what we try to impress is procedure and process and doing things. And that's how we ensure quality as a small brewer is really sticking with our processes and procedures and not winging it. And sticking to our cleaning regimens. And so I think our ability to produce quality beers year after year is really recognized through these awards. I'll just say that because, you know, a lot of people win awards and the beers they enter are great. But I think that if you look at the consistent brewers who are winning awards year after year, you look at the list of those breweries and you see it's some of the best brewers in America. And I really feel that It's our adherence to making the best products, our adherence to quality, our adherence to process and procedure that does that. And if you look at a lot of the award winners, you'll see a lot of beers that we, you know, that are standards, like our Vienna Red Lager that we brew every day. You know, it's one thing that you do a once a year, really crazy seasonal, and it does well. But, mm-hmm. you know, it's the important ones, I think, are the beers that you make each and every day when you show up to work. And I think that really shows the level of quality of the beers we make.
I mean, that is a difference from homebrewing, right? Because you're brewing the same, a lot of times the same beer over and over again, and then trying to get that consistency, that quality out of it again and again. It's a challenge,
yeah,
right?
It is. And, you know, we'll go in, we'll do an evaluation of a brewer's beer, we call it. So we'll sit down in front of 8 beers, and we'll put a score sheet out, and we'll try them. And I always try our light lager. Right. I always go to that first because the light lager, you know, it'll show up any problems that there are in the brewery. I always say that you can see a problem in a brewery by drinking the lightest beer. And I always say to a brewer, when was the last time you sat down and drank a pint of your light lager? You know, and I'll always get, well, I'm like, once a month, you need to sit down because, you know, that's not the beer they're going to go to. Right. We sell a lot of it. Our customers love it. It's not the flavor profile that a brewer is necessarily going to do. But I said, if you want to gauge where you are and what's happening in your brewery, then you need to sit in front of a pint of it once a month. And I think that is always a good way for them to ensure quality.
Certainly one of the more challenging beers to make.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, you've opened a whole bunch more breweries over the year, I think still based on the brew pub restaurant model, and you've got a goal of 20 locations now by 2020. What are some of the keys to managing growth as your business expands?
People, right?
People.
it really, you know, it's not, you know, at this point for us, it's not capital. We're well funded with that. There's plenty of locations out there. There's plenty of great sites that we'd love to be at, you know, and we're always looking at real estate, but it really always comes down to people. And that's the biggest challenge for that's a challenge for every business. And it's a challenge in the restaurant business. It's a challenge in the brewing business, and it's having the right people in the right places. And, you know, we like the expansion for us. I mean, we're like 1,700 employees now, right? I mean,
that's a big number.
That's a big number, right?
Yeah, you start to have problems when you get to those numbers, right?
Unexpected
problems.
We've got the, you know, I don't know everybody's name anymore, right?
No.
And I walk up to them and say, yeah, I introduce myself, and I always the first question I always ask is, how long have you worked for us, right? So if they say they've worked for us for a month, I don't feel bad. If they say like 3 years, I apologize. I'm like, I'm sorry. You've worked for us for 3 years and I don't know you by name.
But still, if you got 1,700 people, that's
yes, hard to, yeah. It does. And so we, but you know, again, it comes down to having the right people in place. You know, we really, you know, brewers certainly within each brewery, assistant brewers, we've got regional brewers that oversee that, and making sure that they're, you know, coaching and mentoring people. And the good thing as we continue to expand is that we create opportunity. And I think, you know, I've always said once we stop expanding, that's when we're going to have a real labor problem, because, you know, people will be like, well, they're not expanding, so, you know, where's my opportunity? I'm going to go somewhere else for opportunity. I think if you create an organization that people can see opportunity in, it becomes a dynamic organization, and that's what we continue to hope to do here at Iron Hill.
Did you run into any problems around 99, 2000? I know there was a bit of a shakeout in craft brewing.
You know, we opened at the wrong time. We opened at the top of the bubble.
Right. Yeah, right before things shook out.
And we all
laugh
at us because there's so many of us that are in the Philadelphia area. We all kind of get together again. It's us, Dogfish, you know, Victory, Yards, Trogues, Sly mm-hmm. Fox, Flying Fish. You know, we all opened within a year of each other, and we're all still here. But we look around at all the people that used to be here that are no longer here.
Yeah.
And And it was a, it was an interesting time to open because, you know, they had, as they say, the bubble burst, but in reality, it was just that the bad producers went out of business, which was good because it left, it wasn't like craft beer sales dropped. It's just there were less craft brewers and it was more for the rest of us to fill the void.
And, you know, I, some people believe that craft beer brewing is getting a little saturated now. Do you think that's the case? The market?
You know, I would say that craft beer will continue to grow in sales, total as a market. But I would agree that it has gotten way more crowded market than it did in the 80s, in the 90s, in the late 90s. And so I think you're going to see the same thing.
7,000 breweries now or something like that?
And I think, yes. And I think what you're going to see is, again, you're going to see a little bit of shakeout. And it's going to be consumer driven. Look, I hate to say it, but there's a lot of, I'm sorry, a little background there.
That's okay.
I'll start again on this, but I hate to say it, but you know, there's some beers that probably shouldn't be on the market. And, and then somebody came in the background. Sorry.
It's all good.
All right.
So,
so what's going to happen is the consumers are going to make choices about beers that probably are lower in quality and stop buying them. And it's going to be driven by the consumer, just like it always is. And the producers in the market that continue to make great products are going to continue to thrive as long as they run their businesses right. Now, the other thing I think you're going to see is everybody is going to be under a little bit of business stress in the next couple of years, right? And unfortunately, I think businesses that make great beer but are poorly run will be victim to it as well. You know, so if you're making great beer and you're running your business right, I think that those will be the businesses that survive. The businesses that will not survive are the ones that are not making great products. And the other ones are just people that are not running their businesses right. You know, there's a lot of businesses getting overextended because they're buying a lot of toys and everything looks good. And the minute that sales start to shrink up on them, they're going to be scrambling for paying bills.
Well, you started, as I mentioned, almost at the very beginning of the U.S. craft beer revolution. What are some of the things that have changed over the years as craft beering has evolved?
You know, the biggest thing is the customer base. The customers are, we have educated customers over the last 20 years tremendously. I mean, think about it. And, you know, back in the late 90s, think about what average customers knew about craft beer and think about what they do now. We have beer drinkers now that don't know a world without craft beer, right?
I mean, that is true.
My kids, I have two children that are over 21 and they don't know a world without craft beer, right? It's always been a part of it. Whereas we remember the days of, you know, three brewing companies and stale imports, right? And so so that has changed tremendously, which is great. You know, we were the ones that did it. You know, the craft brewers were the ones that educated and sucked people in on that. And that only helps us. So, you know, that's great. The innovation that has occurred over the last within craft beer, you know, we've made and American innovation, frankly. I mean, the craft beer movement is purely American. And like everything, we've made everything our own style, right? American IPA, American Pale Ale, American Stout, right? We've put our own twists on
all that. Sours, everything.
Yes, right? And yeah. We take the traditional sours and we've put our spin on them. But, you know, these are American hops. What's interesting is now around the world, everybody's trying to replicate our stuff. Everybody's trying to import our, you know, American grown hops. And that was, you know, beer in the mid 80s and late 80s, you know, The rest of the world was a snob about beer. Like, American beer was just swill, right? That's all you got.
I remember a time when it was, so.
Yes. Well, exactly. And it was, right? And it was the joke of the world, of the brewing world, right? And nobody looked to America for innovation in beer and any of that. And you look today and worldwide, the youngest brewers around the world look to America for the innovation in beer. And that's a significant shift in what has happened in brewing.
Nice. Well, Mark, I know you wanted to cover this. So you have a new competition coming up called Brew of the Legend, targeting homebrewers, of course. So can you tell us a little bit about the competition?
You know, we've always had been a homebrewer. We've always tried to support homebrewers. We host homebrew clubs for their meetings. We give them space to have homebrew competitions and try to support as much as possible because that's our roots. So we've been thinking about this for a while and we decided that we would do our own homebrew competition, right? And so we've worked with homebrew clubs and they're winners. We've brewed their beers before and we're always involved with the Pro-Am, with the Great American Beer Festival. Mm-hmm. And so we decided to do our own competition. So we've divided ourselves into five regions and are taking submissions and entries and we're going to do an initial round of judging and then and get it down to a few and bring in some other beer judges within the industry, and we're going to judge those beers and make a selection in each of our five regions of the winning beer. And then the winner will get to brew that beer, and I'm going to brew with them.
So five different winners, I guess.
Five different winners.
Okay. Right?
And the winners get $500 for winning, and they also we're going to give them a little bit of their beer, and it's going to be.
And they're going to brew a batch on one of your systems, I guess, right?
Yes, and they're going to brew the batch on one of their systems. So and we'll work out within the region what's the best place for them to brew it at, that's closest to them, and I'll be there, and we'll brew it with the head brewer, and we'll ramp up the recipe to our batch size, and that's what we'll do. So we're really excited about it. The initial reaction has been great. The entries have been rolling in. And so we're going to have a lot of beers to work through to do this. So it's a great way to highlight, you know, our roots and to highlight what has continued to explode, which is the American homebrewer.
And what are the deadlines and where can folks learn more or apply for the contest?
Oh, boy. Now you're going to give me the specifics that I don't have right in front of me.
Well, or send them to your website.
Yes. Go to our website, www.ironhillbrewery.com, and it has all the information on the competition.
I'm trying to remember. It closes in January or something like that?
I think December.
December, okay.
The entries, and then the drop-offs are in January. So we'll start the first round of judging in early January.
Awesome. And let's see. Anyways, I want to ask you your closing thoughts. We're getting near the end here, but your closing thoughts after nearly 30 years of home and professional brewing.
Let's see. This is, you know, I couldn't have imagined a more fulfilling career in brewing, you know.
Even better than pharmaceuticals?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, I went from drugs to alcohol, right? I tell people. So it's... you know, the people that you meet, both within the industry and the customers, and, you know, beer for thousands of years has been, you know, the social glue of civilization, and it continues to be. And to be in the middle of that, you know, everybody loves to talk around a beer, right? And to be involved in an industry and a company that gathers people around the table and puts a beer in front of them and allows people to socialize. It's, you know, it's been great.
Well, Mark, I wanted to thank you again for coming on the show. Really appreciate you being here.
Great. Thanks for having me.
And my guest today again was Mark Edelson, founder, owner, and brewer at Iron Hill Brewery in Philadelphia. Thank you again, Mark. Appreciate you.
You're welcome.
A big thank you to Mark Edelson for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They're currently offering 20% off their all-access subscription pass with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith to get your all-access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also the BrewEasy. Brew big in small spaces with the best all-grain, ultra-compact system available. The BrewEasy's revolutionary setup combines batch barge efficiency, brew-in-a-bag simplicity, and the wort clarification of a rim system. It's easy to set up, easy to operate, and easy on the eyes. It's also the system that I personally brew on. Visit BlickmanEngineering.com for more information. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And as I mentioned earlier, I recently converted the BeersmithRecipes.com website to support mobile devices and also added the majority of the Beersmith brewing and unit conversion tools to the site. Subscribers to Beersmith 3 can access over 17 brewing tools online from any device, and anyone with an account can browse from tens of thousands of recipes. Visit BeersmithRecipes.com to set up your free account from your phone or computer and learn more. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.